I'm Iris McAlpin, and you're listening to Pure Curiosity, an exploration of the human experience and what it takes to be mentally healthy in our modern world. Hi, Brad. How are you?
Great. How are you, Iris?
I'm doing, you know what? It's a weird question to answer right now, I feel like, in a way, because I'm a lot of things, depending on the day, on the time of day, all of that. And yeah, this is obviously a very unusual time that we're in. And I am curious to ask that question less in a social politeness way, but really, how are you doing right now?
Well, right now I'm feeling good about connecting with you. I think, you know, I've been at home for 3 weeks now, so any kind of connection with people that I enjoy connecting with is really great.
Yes.
So, you know, and I enjoy our conversation, so I'm happy about that. And, you know, I know we're going to get into this more, but it's all about a balance. It's about how do we maintain kind of a balance. And like you said, there's moments that I feel really connected and hopeful and settled inside, and then there's other moments that I don't. And so, you know, just right now, feeling good, feeling excited about our conversation.
Awesome. Thank you. Yeah. And for those who maybe didn't listen to the last podcast with you, can you tell us a little bit about who you are?
Sure. Yeah. So I'm a somatic-oriented psychotherapist, which basically means that I'm really interested in the body-mind connection. And I've been in this field for over 20 years now, and really specifically focused in trauma. I did humanitarian aid work before I came into psychology, so that's kind of where my interest in trauma came from. So I am very interested in collective trauma, like what we're experiencing now, and how to support not just individuals but also communities. So I live in kind of wine country, a couple hours north of San Francisco. I'm a professor at two different universities, and I have a private practice as well. And then as you and I met, I'm a trainer in the neuroaffective relational model, which is a clinical approach for working with complex trauma. And I also am trained and a trainer in somatic experiencing, which is a body psychotherapy model for working more with shock trauma, although it addresses many other components as well.
Thank you for that. So cool, all the things that you do.
Yeah. I like the diversity of it, so it's fun.
Yeah. And, you know, I wasn't necessarily planning on talking about this, but because you brought up the humanitarian aid work, I'm sort of curious how your experience working in humanitarian aid, obviously in a crisis situation, is informing your perspective on what we're going through right now, if there's an overlap at all, but there is some.
It's a great question. I've been thinking about this because, you know, as people ask me how I'm doing, you know, I do think in some way I'm more prepared perhaps than many people. You know, this word privilege gets thrown around a lot, particularly in social justice kind of circles. But there's a larger idea of the sense of privilege that, you know, we take for granted having running water, having electricity that doesn't go out multiple times a day, you know, not having military come into our house, you know, at any given moment. We don't get stopped on the highways by the military, and there's no checkpoints in the United States. And, you know, there's just so many things that, like, we do take for granted that I guess you could call us very privileged in that way. And I think I was very impacted by my experiences when I lived in Asia and did the humanitarian aid work, where, you know, I just saw that, you know, in real time that you didn't need all the trappings of Western civilization to find connection and happiness.
Mm, yeah.
And these are people that had been run out of their homes. Many of them that I worked closely with had been imprisoned as political prisoners, tortured. You know, a lot of them were working in sweatshops and horrible living conditions. And yet I was so drawn to the ways of you know, I guess we could call them like resources that they had within their communities and within themselves that they had been raised with, that it, you know, I don't want to idealize them because there's still a lot of trauma and a lot of challenges in these communities. But at the same time, I used to think back a lot about like my friends and my family back in the United States, and like we would never be able to live through some of the things that some of my friends, my Burmese friends that I worked with, lived through. And I think that there is, you know, through trauma, there does come some kind of resiliency that you know, for better and for worse, that we get built in with. And particularly when you have more of these kind of community and generational connections and rituals built in, that really helps to know how to address things when huge things like this go on.
Yeah, I'm very interested in what you said about, you know, your friends back in the United States would never be able to handle some of the things that you were witnessing happening there. I've been thinking about this a lot because we have been quite insulated from a lot of tragedy. I mean, it's hard to say that because, of course, everyone has their own life experience, and some people in the U.S. have obviously experienced some very horrific things, but collectively, our culture hasn't been through the ringer the way some others have. And I'm just sort of interested how you think this will impact us more collectively.
Well, yeah, that question doesn't have such a positive answer, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But I mean, I you know, I remember watching after 9/11 and also after like Hurricane Katrina, and, you know, times like this where we have been challenged collectively. There hasn't been that many over the last 20 or 30 years, but, you know, maybe some of the school shootings and things like this, that it's like we all are in that together. It doesn't matter your race, your religion, your gender, your sexual orientation. It's like we're all impacted by these things, you know, like 9/11, for example, or Hurricane Katrina. You know, it's like everyone's impacted by this. And what I've observed is that for a few days or maybe in a few weeks after these experiences, people come together in that way. Like we're designed. I don't remember who it was, but there was some stress researcher that said that the main chemical of stress is not adrenaline. It's not cortisol. It's actually oxytocin.
Yeah.
And the idea is that when we get under stress, we release oxytocin, which helps us to stay connected to each other, bring us closer to each other. And I think that happens. And I've been feeling that, you know, after in the last couple of weeks, like there's a way that I've connected with people I haven't connected with in several years and just in the last few weeks, and the way that different communities are coming together online and all that kind of thing. And, you know, all the videos you see online about people, they probably haven't talked to their neighbors in months or years, and they're coming and playing music, you know, on their balcony with them and stuff. But the difficulty or the tragedy of it is that's short lasting usually. So once we, you know, kind of get through this immediate period and things kind of start turning into a new normal, generally people start kind of competing for resources. And I'm not talking just like toilet paper. I'm talking like just people start kind of going inward and focusing less on community and more on like, okay, what do they need to do to survive? And I think it's a physiological reaction too. I think there's a contraction that happens physiologically where people, you know, start to kind of hunker down. And unfortunately, it disengages the social engagement system. So it like disconnects us from things that are like kindness and curiosity, you know, and open-heartedness, generosity, those kind of things really start to break down. And that's what I, you know, that I'm trying to work on. That's the level I'm trying to work on when I'm, you know, teaching and working with people around traumas. Like, how do we use our traumatic experiences, you know, not to just kind of quiet the symptoms so that we can go back to, you know, where we were before, but how do we actually use the traumatic reactions to shift in a way that's going to really open us up to a new way of being.
Yeah. That's the concept of post-traumatic growth that I know we've talked about a little bit before, but if somebody's listening to this and wanting to do something to move themselves more toward the open-hearted compassion response rather than the like hoarding or protecting their resources response, I'm sure it varies quite a bit person to person, but are there any things in particular you talk to people about if they're facing that?
Yeah, you know, people might not love the answer I'm about to say, but I mean, you've been introduced to this, but it's we have a way in NARM, the neuroaffective relational model, we have a way of teaching our clients or working with our clients, supporting our clients around their emotions. And one of the things we learn from the very first moments of our life as children, at least in the United States, I can speak for, is that we're really trained to disconnect from our internal world. We're trained to like not be connected to our bodies very much. We're trained not to be connected to our emotions. You know, we're hyper kind of, you know, intellectualized in this society. Those are the things that are kind of more valued in terms of like how we can perform and achieve, and not so much about like what's happening in our inner world. And so as far as answering your question, I mean, I think kind of we use all these strategies to kind of continue to move away from ourselves and busy ourselves. And really what, from our perspective, what's needed is to turn towards ourselves and how do we stay present with some of these really scary and unsettling emotions like helplessness, grief, fear, anger, you know, these emotions that generally we spend a lot of our life energy running away from. And how can we stay present with them and not just stay present with them, but then once we're present with them, how do we not get kind of, you know, pulled into them in a, you know, a negative way, but how can we actually use them to support ourselves and to support, you know, what we're trying to do out in the world?
That is a perfect segue into something that I really wanted to talk about. I mean, two emotions that I'm seeing come up the most, well, there's quite a few, but the helplessness, the grief, uncertainty, these are the very prevalent themes right now. And for people that want to move through them, want to use those for their own personal growth, but find that experience very scary, sitting with those feelings very scary, you know, how do we build that capacity to hold those things?
Yeah, I mean, it is scary. There's no way getting around it. I mean, yeah. the virus is scary. You know, what we're doing to our environment even before this is scary. I mean, there's a lot of things that are really scary. And, you know, our ancestors lived through very scary things. And I just think that it's just part of human nature. It's part of just nature itself that, like, we have to face things that are really uncertain and overwhelming and potentially life-changing at the drop of the hat. And we have absolutely no way of controlling those things. You know, a lot of more Eastern traditions teach about practices that help you with dealing with helplessness and surrendering and things like this. And there's, I think there's a lot of that in the model of psychotherapy that I, you know, work with and teach, which is really learning how to be more okay with helplessness and more okay with the grief and the fear that comes up with it. And I know I'm making it sound kind of simple here on paper or whatever, but I think just the intention of like that, you know, I'm going to learn about, instead of like having a feeling of fear or helplessness and trying to do everything I can to like get away from it by busying myself or, you know, doing something to kind of distance myself from that, how can I maybe take 1 or 2 seconds longer just to kind of see what's going on inside before I go and busy myself or do something else? Like, even that intention, I believe, is moving us in the right direction.
Yeah, that sounds right. I've noticed for myself, and I'll be interested to hear what your experience has been with this, but, you know, my usual meditation time has been insufficient in this time. My usual self-care has been insufficient. I've had to kind of 10x the things that I've been doing to really carve out some time for me to sit with my feelings and my emotions and reactions that are inevitably coming up right now. And even this morning, like prepping for the podcast, you know, forcing myself to sit and just be with whatever was present. And it's not always comfortable. Sometimes it's quite uncomfortable. And I also find that the more I do that, the more ability I have to sit and be with myself, no matter what's there.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, it's interesting time, of course, because so many of us are shut in our homes, and you know, there's difference in terms of people that feel more extroverted versus introverted too. I mean, I think people that are more self-reflective, more you know, used to being kind of introverted, it's maybe less of a challenge than people that are really, they find a lot of resource by being out in the world and being really stimulated by the outside world. And so that's kind of an interesting flip, because in our society, you know, American society, it tends to be much more extroverted. And this is a little bit of a different time where I think people, I know I have friends and family members that are much more extroverted than I am. And I think it's much more of a challenge for them to do the things like you said, like just kind of slow down, take some time to sit and be present. I mean, those are not things that they're used to doing. So that's also a challenge.
Yeah, I'm realizing I am kind of okay with the quarantine lifestyle. I mean, I do have a virtual business, so that helps. I mean, I'm engaging with people all day via video chat, but it's less of an adjustment for me than I thought it was going to be, truth be told.
I've been hearing that quite a bit. You know, I work with a lot of therapists now, so you know, I think maybe therapists tend to be a little bit more on the introverted kind of self-reflective side of things.
True.
But you know, it's, I think we all have our different kind of days and moments as well. And I feel very fortunate myself that I live in the country, so I can really easily get out. So even if they tried to blockade the streets, you know, I could still get out into nature very easily.
Yeah.
So for me, that's a really big resource. But I know that, you know, people that live in cities or people that live in different situations don't have that connection. And you know, again, nature isn't a resource for everyone, but I think a lot of people, nature can be something that is very grounding. And if you live in the city, you know, and you can't go to the parks right now, you can't go to the beach if you live in San Francisco or whatever it is, you know, that's a huge resource that's been taken away.
Yeah. I'm curious for you, just on a personal level, what kinds of practices have you been engaging in to keep yourself in a more balanced state?
Yeah, well, let's see. You know, I like you, it's been easier for me to continue my work, because I do a lot of consultations with mental health professionals, and so those are already online. And I've already, you know, my teaching has very easily transferred online, so my college classes are online, and you know, we're taking some of our professional trainings that we do online. So in some ways, that's been really nice for me, because work for me is something I'm very passionate about. I really believe in my work. I really enjoy it. It's very creative for me. And I know, again, I'm kind of privileged in that way that not everyone has that kind of work, but that's a huge resource for me. You know, it's also a distraction. I mean, it really is. I mean, I have a son at home right now, and my partner has to be his kind of full-time teacher. And, you know, I sometimes I'm upstairs in my room working like now on our podcast, really, you know, feeling grateful that I'm not having to like go through all of his sixth grade math and stuff. And, you know, so that, I mean, that's another part of it. It's like I enjoy the distraction of my work, because my work is really interesting to me, and I love working with people in this way. I love teaching about it. I love thinking about it. So for me, that's really easy. You know, I like I said, I have nature, which is very easy to me. Oh, another piece of my work, which I think is a really important thing in our society, which is this idea of like giving to other people and being there for other people. And like, you know, I've lived and traveled around the world, and so, you know, for a while I lived in the Middle East and stuff, and traveled quite extensively there. And you know, in different cultures, they have different ways of like hospitality, and this idea of like generosity is not something they have to practice. It's like built into their community. Like, you know, if you're in their house, it's like you're part of their family at that point. And I think that there's something built into many communities, many cultures, that they're not so centered just on themselves and their own experience. We live in a much more individualistic society. And I don't believe that, especially at times like this, that that's going to be very helpful for people, because I think that can very easily lead to isolation. It can lead to disconnection. It can lead to what I was saying before, where people start to kind of get pulled into their own needs and their own experiences in a way that disconnects them from other people. And so that's another thing that helps me, is that I feel really good about helping people. And, you know, like coming on your podcast or working with my clients, it's like there's a way that feels really meaningful to me, to be able to share some of my experiences and my knowledge in a way that might be helpful to people.
I definitely feel that. Yeah, that has been a really important part of this whole process for me, is really pouring myself into my work while also, you know, making sure that I have time to clear myself and be present with my own feelings as well. But
yeah,
it is very helpful to be able to be of service to people in a time like this. And I notice that sort of almost primal part of me comes up sometimes, where it's like, okay, you need to be really focusing on conserving your resources, like some of these things that you've mentioned.
Yeah.
And I'm also noticing this deeper desire underneath that to show up and contribute. And so I think for me, something that's been helping has been just bringing awareness to those things, and also just building that muscle of continuously turning toward the part of me that wants to contribute. Because ultimately, yeah, that's much more enriching and enlivening for me than the other one.
Yeah, and I think there's a piece of it too where, you know, it counteracts some of the helplessness. I mean, for yeah, better and for worse, it's like we talk about this, as you know, in the trainings, that a lot of people come in to become therapists or social workers, things like this, because of their own, you know, unresolved issues or patterns in childhood. And, you know, there's better and worse for that. It's good because it allows us you know, people that have that kind of tendency tend to be much more empathic, tend to be able to go and hold space for people and be with stronger emotions. And then, of course, there's a flip side where sometimes, you know, it can get in our way. But I think in times like this, it really is a very positive thing, because, you know, when you're sitting with things that you can't do anything about, it's really difficult. I mean, even in our nervous system, it like builds up trapped energy that can, you know, lead to different kind of symptoms or different kind of maladaptive behaviors. And I think that, you know, people that are on the front lines, or people like us that are working actively with clients that are really struggling, or, you know, we might have clients ourselves that are working on the front lines. You know, in some ways that's really helpful, because it's like, then we can do things immediately. So like, you know, I'm sure all of us see things on Facebook or online of people that are like doing really cool projects, like in bringing food to elderly people, or, you know, all sorts of things that people are doing. I think that's really important as a way of counteracting the hopelessness, the helplessness. Like, you know, it is nice to be able to like binge on Netflix and read books, you know, read books you haven't read, and, you know, use recipes you haven't used in a long time, drink that bottle of wine that you've been waiting on. Those are all fine and important, but it's equally important, I think, to at least reflect on little ways that you can contribute. And I mean, even if it's a really small thing, where, you know, just being kind on social media to other people,
yeah,
you know, or sending kind of a cute meme to a friend that you haven't talked to in a while, like just even little small things that can bring some, you know, positivity into someone else's life. I think those things can go a long way.
I think so too. And I'm glad you brought up the wine, because it kind of made me think of another topic that I've been thinking a lot about recently, because I have quite a few clients who have suddenly reverted back to some old coping strategies that they thought were in the past, eating disorder behaviors, drinking behaviors, you know, compulsive shopping, all kinds of different things.
Yeah.
And to me, I see that more as a reflection of the intensity of the experience they're having rather than a reflection of their progress. But I'm interested in how you're holding things like that are showing up right now.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. It takes us kind of deeper into the NARM model, which is this understanding that early issues that happen to us, early trauma, early adverse experiences, lead to different kind of what we call survival strategies. And so we look at things like eating disorders or addictions at, we don't look at them through the lens of disease or pathology. We look at them as survival strategies that basically, children and then into adults, we basically learn ways to manage ourselves to the best of our ability, even if they have high cost to them, because at one point in time, the cost seemed less than the feelings themselves that we were trying to manage. So, so much of those kind of behaviors come around trying to find some semblance of control over a life that feels out of control. And, unfortunately, it gets directed internally. So we take this anger, this, upset that we have towards whatever might be going on around us, and we end up directing it back towards ourselves. And so it makes sense that in times where we don't have a lot of control over anything going on right now, that one of the ways unconsciously that we try to find some semblance of control is by resorting to these old patterns that worked for us when we were younger on some level.
This is why I love Narm so much. Yeah, I mean, there's a deep respectfulness there for the utility of these strategies, even if they're not ideally what we want to keep around. There's always an ability to learn other strategies for managing intense feelings, but that's very much how I've been holding it.
Yeah, and I know you know this, but I'm just saying this for people that are listening, that basically the first place to start is that, like you said, that deep respect, that understanding, because one of the things when you turn it into a disease or a pathology, or even worse, like a moral failing, which our society did for so long, it creates shame. It creates a sense that, I'm bad, I'm doing something wrong, I have to hide it, all that kind of stuff. And it's like, we truly are doing the best we can with, given everything that's happened to us in our life, giving everything that we have, we're doing the best we can. Now, that doesn't mean that we're wanting to continue that or wanting to promote that, but it means that we're meeting ourselves through greater understanding, greater acceptance, greater compassion, hopefully. And that's the only place you can start. I mean, you can't really change yourself through self-hatred. Maybe you can change the behavior, but something else will pop up in its place.
Yeah.
So we really have to find a way, again, your podcast is all based on this, about this deep curiosity and really meeting ourselves with that curiosity, with that openness, with that understanding, with that compassion.
I'm curious to hear your thoughts on why this sort of illusion that self-hatred will create positive behavior change is so prevalent.
Oh boy. Well, you might be taking me into territory I could get in trouble for here, but
I love it. Let's do it.
Well, I mean, I'll just say this. It's very built into Western civilization for many thousands of years now. It's built into our major religions. It's built into, the basic principles that have guided Western societies. This basic idea that somehow humans are bad and that we need to kind of create all these different ways of being and structures to make them better. That whole idea doesn't make sense to me at all. But that is the prevailing kind of Western, belief, and it's built into so many of our systems. And so it's hard. It's hard to kind of undo that because so many people buy into that. The medical model, I mean, even in psychology, the DSM that we use in psychology, I mean, again, a lot of people's religious kind of teachings and guidance.
Yeah.
There's just a lot of emphasis. I'm not part of the 12 steps, but I know a lot of people that are, and I've had a lot of clients that are. I mean, it's built into a lot of different things. And there's just a lack of inherent trust that humans, given the right kind of support and conditions, will not want to treat themselves like that. And if we can create those kind of conditions, I think that we won't see those kind of behaviors. I mean, they have research with rats in the laboratory and stuff that, give them the right kind of environment and they won't go over and suck on the water that has the heroin or cocaine or whatever it was. I can't remember the study.
I think it was heroin.
Yeah. And then the ones that are put in cages by themselves, they'll suck on that all day long because it's like the pain they need to do something with the pain.
Yeah.
And that pain is not, I don't believe at all. I mean, I just can't believe that that pain is inherent to us. I don't believe we're born with that. I believe that that's something that gets created.
I agree with that. We see it in children all the time. That's why children are so wonderful to be around. They have this like beautiful, creative life force energy that wants to connect.
Yeah.
And at some point, that gets shut down. And when we aren't able to express ourselves in that way, I think it's natural to have to find coping strategies to
Yeah.
manage that because it's a lot of trapped energy.
Yeah.
And it does seem to me like, and I think the religion piece is probably pretty important. I went to a Southern Baptist school for 8 years that had a lot of hellfire and brimstone kind of stuff where everything was shameful and just a lot of judgment. And I could see how some of that way of thinking definitely permeated my own self-talk in terms of, the shame and guilt and stuff like that. And I could see how that could be a big piece of perpetuating this narrative that we have to guilt ourselves or shame ourselves in order to stay in line.
Yeah, I mean, I did this, I have this great job that I go to these trainings and I get to meet all these wonderful people, and a lot of them trust me enough to come up to the front of the class to demonstrate NARM. And I had this wonderful experience in Florida, my training in Florida, where there was a guy who, a gay man as an adult, who grew up just in, I mean, he called it a fundamentalist kind of. Basically would have been a cult if it wasn't Christian. Oh my God, I mean, it was such a powerful session to see him shift from cognitively as a 40 or 50 year old man. He knows that all these things he doesn't believe in anymore, but in his bones, in his tissues, every fiber of his body believes in what he was being taught, that all around these ideas of sin and, like you said, going to hell for eternity and all this kind of stuff. And it was just amazing to be able to support him to come into himself in a new way that was really starting to shift these implicit beliefs and implicit kind of feelings that had held him back in many ways from being, even though he was out as a gay man, but just from his being authentic as a human being. And it's just amazing to see that, but it's also the flip side is it's really sad to think about how many people like that are out there that are not getting this kind of support to shift out of these patterns, and in fact are continuing to raise the next generation of children. I mean, I know it's less, it's less that this is happening, fortunately. But then of course there's a flip side of it is that, the real positive thing about religion and about churches and things like this is that it gave us more of a sense of community. And now we just don't have that as much in our lives. And so there is a loss to it too. It's like, not growing up with a sense of that kind of orientation to a community and connection, I think is also a loss. So it's like, it's not like we don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. It's like there was some really wonderful things about it. There is wonderful things about, religious communities, but how can we maybe bring some of these trauma-informed principles into them where they might be able to use the religious teachings in a way that's much more supportive and kind of life-affirming?
I think that's so important. And talking about this is bringing up a question for me that is more related to coronavirus again. But I'm wondering how you're seeing what's happening right now, maybe bringing up some very deep developmental themes for people.
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, Larry and I did a podcast last week that we talked a little bit about that, which is this idea of like, there's two things. There's fear and there's anxiety, and we differentiate those in NARM. Fear is a response to a real threat. So we're walking in the woods and there's a bear, and the bear starts growling at us. We're not being anxious. I mean, it's turning on a very deep brain and nervous system response of fear that triggers this whole sequence of neurochemicals to be released, our body to produce certain responses that are going to optimize our chances of surviving that experience. So fear is really important actually to have, because it's an important message for how we need to respond to a threat in our environment. The challenge is that anxiety develops through childhood, through childhood trauma, when we've had to disconnect from ourselves in different ways. And so we talk about anxiety being a signal for something else, and it's like something that's incomplete inside of us. And with developmental trauma, we generally focus on two emotions that get incomplete throughout childhood, although it's not so simplistic. But but the basic two emotions are grief, which has to do with loss, and anger, which has to do with like a certain kind of protest, like this isn't okay for me, like what's happening in my environment. And those two emotions are too overwhelming for children to experience. They pose too much of a threat, and so we have to disconnect from them. So now fast forward to when we're adults and we're dealing with these real fears, it goes back to what we were talking about at the beginning of this podcast, which is like, how do we sit with helplessness? How do we sit with ourselves and facing this real fear in the world and the fact that there's not that much we can do about it? And I think the anxiety comes from that place of like that feels so close to what it felt like as a child, that we were helpless. We had no agency. We couldn't do anything about the things that were happening or not happening in our environment. And that anxiety feels very familiar to a lot of us, and it can take it has its own life. Like it can take us in very difficult directions. People start to catastrophize, people start to do also, and then like I said before, people also just on a somatic level, on a nervous system level, they start to contract. And when people start to contract over a period of time, when your body's actually contract in a contractive state, that leads to things like digestive problems, pain issues, a whole sort of both medical and emotional issues that can come out of that. Mm-hmm. So, we try to work with the differentiation between how do we be with the real fear that's in front of us and how that kind of triggers or brings up some of this older stuff. It's hard. It's not easy. It's really difficult to like differentiate that, because it's so intertwined.
I was smiling as you were talking about this, not because that's necessarily the happiest subject matter, but I just think it's so important for people to understand that distinction between fear and anxiety. And that was a real point of exploration for me when I first learned that from you. Because yeah. I had never conceptualized anxiety quite in that way before.
Yeah. And I mean, it goes off, as it goes off into much deeper levels, but it is important because in our society, there's always two sides to things, but like in our society, one of the really important things that's happened over the last 10 or 15 years is this whole idea around everyone now knows the word trauma, basically. Yeah. And whereas 35 years ago, it was still very controversial. Now everyone knows it, everyone uses it. And part of the understanding of trauma is that you have to have safe environments. And so, how do you create safety in the therapy office? How do you create safety in schools? How do you create safety in our culture? And see, there's an important distinction between safety and security. And safety has to do more with fear. Like I, my kids need to know that they can go to school and not be shot, right?
Yeah.
Like that's a safety issue. That's a fear issue. But my kids are going to be bullied. They're going to be, made fun of. There's going to be different things that happen that challenge their security of themselves. And see, those are different issues. And it does in some indirect way relate to the coronavirus, because it's like we need to think about safety first, obviously. And then once safety is established, then it becomes more about our own sense of security. It's like right now, me and my family have been sheltered for over 2 weeks. We've almost 3 weeks now. And so our risk of getting infected is super, super low. I mean, almost negligible. And our risk of infecting other people is the same. It's almost negligible. So the fear, at least in my immediate environment, is very low. But that doesn't mean that my anxiety is low, because every time I go on Twitter or I read the news or whatever, my anxiety starts getting really triggered. And that's this balance between, like, how do I deal with immediate fear? And if I was able to, I should say, when I'm able to manage my anxiety, I can actually address the fear, whether it's my fear or whether it's fear of people that I'm trying to work with. I can address it so much better and much more effectively, because I'm not getting hung up in all of the anxiety patterns.
That makes a lot of sense. If this is a redundant question, we can skip it, but I am curious when anxiety does show itself for you, are there certain things that help you move through that more quickly?
Well, yeah, I mean, some of the things we talked about before, but laughter. I enjoy laughing. I mean, I think being a trauma therapist for over 20 years now, it's like I can't watch a lot of the movies that people recommend to me to watch, because it's like they're way too close to the work that I've done. So I need to come home and watch. Like, I can't tell you how many times I've watched The Office series and, Parks and Recreation, and, like, things that just are silly and light and fun. And so my family, we laugh a lot. And that's something that's really helpful.
That's great.
And I personally, is my own personal sense of myself, is I'm pretty self-disciplined, and I kind of just get to a place, because, I'll spend half an hour on Twitter or whatever, reading through things and getting into some really, dark places, reading about some of the stuff out there. And I feel like it's important. It's important for me to know what's going on, and it's important for me to, like, take in different perspectives. And then at some point, I just say to myself, like, okay, I'm done. Like, it's now going to start turning into something that's not useful anymore. Or maybe I missed it. Maybe 5 minutes ago, it turned into something that's not. Now I'm just starting to get afraid, and I can feel the tension. I start to, feel those anxiety patterns for myself. And so I just do the best I can to kind of monitor myself when I go down those rabbit holes.
That's helpful. I feel like that is a muscle that absolutely can be built, because I've noticed myself increasingly more able to do that. Really, thanks to NARM, able to just bring that awareness and, like, oh, okay, yeah, this is not particularly useful right now. Maybe I can redirect
Exactly.
and
Well,
also
that
move the energy through. For me, like, movement is always really helpful, but laughing is another very good way to do that.
yeah, Iris, I was going to say another thing is that, so I because I said, like, I have this self-discipline, that I think that self-discipline is part of my character, but I think there's another really important piece that you just mentioned, kind of indirectly for yourself, that also I want to name for myself, is that I've been doing my own personal work for many, many years now. And I mean, nonstop for 25 years or whatever. And that's really important, because that does give me an ability to not be so afraid of my internal states. It doesn't mean I'm perfect at all. Like, I'm totally not perfect. I still deal with all the things everyone else deals with. But I think part of it is what I was saying, is self-discipline. But part of it's like, okay, I'm much more aware of when I'm hitting that threshold. Like, I know, like, oh, this is starting to not feel okay for me, and I need to shift into something new. And I think people that maybe haven't, spent as much time kind of getting to know their internal worlds might not know that state as much as, people that have done more internal work. And so I'm just a huge believer that psychotherapy, and, specifically psychotherapy, but I think other things can also be useful. There's, coaching and spiritual guidance and things like this, and meditation. But I just think there's something about psychotherapy, about the relational aspects of having someone to support you to really reflect on your internal world and how your internal world interacts with the world around you, is a huge, God, what's the word? It's like, it inoculates you in some way, against certain things. It's again, it's not, nothing's perfect, but I do think that helps a lot for me too.
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned the length of time that you've been working on yourself. And I also just want to say for myself, I'm 34. I've been in therapy since I was 12, so that's 22 years of deep personal work that I've also been engaged in pretty nonstop. And so if you're listening to this and feel like, why am I feeling anxious? Why are these things showing up for me? No matter how much work you've done, it's human and natural to have some difficult and complicated feelings arising right now. And so I just want to normalize
Oh
that.
yeah.
And
It's a lifelong process. I mean,
exactly.
it's like
Yes.
you never quote unquote heal from early trauma. It's like you develop a different kind of relationship with it, and it does get easier and gets so much more. It stops turning into something that kind of holds you back and starts turning into something that kind of supports you to move forward in your life. But it's always there. It's always part of us. And we're going to be dealing with it forever in different ways. And I think that that's another part of like turning and being with it as opposed to running from it, that, we can't change the past. We can't change the things that have scarred us or hurt us, but we can start to develop new relationships with them that will actually create greater resiliency and greater possibility.
Yeah, absolutely. There's something that's kind of out of left field that I would love to ask you about. I feel like I would be remiss to have you on my podcast again and not ask you this.
Great.
Something that you mentioned in one of our trainings that was deeply impactful for me, just in terms of, gosh, I don't even know. It was one of those like deep light bulb moments where you differentiated between freedom and empowerment. And I would just love it if you would share some of that.
Yeah. Well, it's another area that I could get potentially into a little hot water, but this one feels a little safer. I think again, it's one of these things that I want to be very mindful about my language because this idea of empowerment has been so important. Like if you think about women's empowerment in the 60s and 70s, I mean that was just so necessary, or the civil rights and empowering African Americans in our country. I mean, there's so many things that have happened, both collectively and individually, that when people are given or not given, well, either given or take inside themselves or inside their communities more of a sense of empowerment, that can propel them to a new level for themselves, and that's super important. But I view it as just one step along the process. It's like if you think about like a I don't know, some of you might know Maslow's hierarchy of needs. It's like you kind of go from one stage to the next stage. So empowerment is very important, but from my perspective, it doesn't stop there. And I call it the Frankenstein theory,
I love this.
which is basically that, like, in the Frankenstein story, this doctor, he took different parts of a bo bodies from different corpses, and he sewed them together into this monster. And the monster was just laying there in his laboratory. It wasn't alive. It was just laying there. And then all of a sudden it got hit by lightning or whatever, and it got animated. And so I always talk about, in my trainings, it's like, what do you imagine a monster that has increased levels of energy will do with that energy? And it's going to be more of a monster. That's all it's going to do. It's going to take, if you give it more energy, it's going to use that energy to be more of a monster. I mean, you can see that even politically how that happens and stuff. So this idea works on individuals too. It's like for someone that has these long-term patterns of shame and self-hatred and self-rejection, if you empower them, you're often what they're going to do is use the energy for greater ways of either acting in towards themselves or acting out towards their environment. And that's not necessarily going to be supportive to them or to the world they live in. And so the idea is that, like, it's not just giving people ex like more empowered energy. It's what do they, how do they relate to that energy? How do they relate to themselves? And then the options that are there. Like a really simple example is like, you'll have therapists that will be like, basically like cheerleading their clients to like stand up to their boss. Their boss has been,
Yeah.
neglecting them and not giving them a raise, and they'll work with them for months about like going in and really, standing up for themselves with their boss. And I think that's potentially really dangerous, actually, because, if this person's working paycheck to paycheck and you empower this person to find their strength and walk in and, advocate for themselves, they could lose their job. And like that, okay, that is one option. That's one option that maybe they will, with this increased sense of energy or confidence, maybe they'll go and walk into their boss's office. But there might be other possibilities of things they might want to do. And, as you know, I mean, I'm dropping a big concept here at the end of our podcast, but basically, it's like this idea of like adult consciousness versus child consciousness, which is basically this idea that, even from a neurobiological perspective, we want the energy, the increased levels of energy, to be running through all circuits of the brain, including, the prefrontal areas of the brain, because that's where we can really be much more reflective, be more mindful. We can go slower. We can think through things a little bit more clearly, and that they're not coming so reactively, which is more of what we refer to as the child consciousness, which is more the lower brain states, lower brain systems. And so this is just a kind of a basic example of like what would be more useful, I think, as from the therapist perspective, is to really spend time both, supporting the client to feel more of their energy, to feel more empowered, to feel more of their confidence, and then to be reflective about what are the possibilities that might be available to them to do with that energy. And, that is a step that's often, missing because there's like a predetermined belief of what's going to be good for that person. And, so that's just like a little basic idea of it. But I think it is important because we don't understand that, sometimes freedom means not doing anything. It's, it's not so much about a behavior, it's about a state. And so, empowerment is more focused generally on like a behavior, like what can I do with this increased level of energy or confidence? And the state is that we can be okay no matter what happens and to reflect on the different possibilities that happen.
Yeah, I think that's so important because empowerment coaching especially is so popular, and I think in some cases it's extremely helpful and extremely necessary, but I do think it often misses that final piece, and so I'm glad that we were able to articulate that.
And as you know, I mean, people that come into NARM training, a big part of NARM, the word neuroaffective relational model, the R is really important, the relational piece, because as therapists, we're humans. We're people too that have our own unresolved issues and patterns, and so we have our own agendas, whether they're conscious or unconscious. And so sometimes what we're trying to coach our clients on is actually coming from our own agenda, not so much of what's going to be the best thing for them. And it's hard to be real with ourselves about that, but it's important because sometimes we can actually act out on our clients in ways that can be, can be counterproductive or even harmful.
Yeah, and that's why, just a plug for NARM, I guess. Part of the reason that I've been so taken with it is that there is a tremendous amount of consideration for that, and the humility that's present in acknowledging that therapists and healers also have their own shit to work out, for lack of better terms, and that is an important part of the process of working with your clients is acknowledging and taking responsibility internally for your own experience so that we don't unconsciously act out on the people that we're really wanting to help.
And just for the listeners, I just want to kind of qualify what you said. You called it shit, which is kind of what we do in our society. But see, we got to be careful because that generally is being seen through the lens that we have a certain way that we treat ourselves based on our unresolved stuff. It's like, oh, I got all this baggage, I got all this shit. It's like, from my perspective, it's not shit at all. It's actually, it's part of us. And I know you didn't mean it like that, but
Well, I'm glad
it's
you're
interesting.
calling that out because that's an easy thing to step over, and I'm glad you didn't.
Because it's just, again, it's these subtle ways that we treat ourselves. And it doesn't mean that we like these parts of ourselves necessarily. Like, if you have all this anxiety or you have a, an a pattern inside yourself that you don't like, it's not that you have to love that part of yourself, but we have to start relating to it differently for it to truly change.
Yes.
And that's hard. It's really hard.
It is. And I guess maybe to wrap this whole thing up, how do we start doing that? I mean, I know we've talked about this a lot in the trainings, but if somebody is sitting with a part of themselves that they really hate, what next?
Well, I do think it's going to be a lot easier to do it with someone else, particularly with a professional that has the ability to sit with that, because a lot of our friends and family, they care about us and they just want it to change, you know, they can't kind of sit and be as patient as a professional can be. So I think it's helpful to take that to some place where you can really get support around that. And I think, you know, you said this earlier, but just that we're all in this. I mean, we all have these patterns and we're just doing the best we can with them and just really taking it kind of one step at a time and being kind with ourselves, being compassionate, being patient with ourselves and trying to learn the best we can.
Thank you. Thank you so much for all of this. This has been wonderful.
Yeah, it's been great. I look forward to our future conversations.
Me too.